Hello, it's John Dennis. It's Tuesday, the 24th of March. Today, evidence of alleged Israeli war crimes in Gaza are uncovered by a Guardian investigation.
It's very, very difficult to know why so many medical workers were targeted and why so many hospitals, because it was actually 15 of Gaza's 27 hospitals were damaged by Israeli fire.
Barack Obama's administration unveils a $1 trillion scheme to lance the boil of the money markets by buying toxic assets.
The good news is that we have one more critical element in our recovery, but we've still got a long way to go.
And Labour and the Tories compete over our rights and responsibilities.
What we're actually talking about is a kind of major debate shaping up for the party manifestos of that coming general election expected next year.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton's taking responsibility for today's news headlines and today's papers.
Details of the UK's counter-terrorism strategy are published today, including government concerns about weapons that could fall into terrorist hands. The updated strategy has a new section about the risk of chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear weapons. Its recommendations include training members of the public, such as shop managers and security workers, on how to react to a terror incident. A 17-year-old boy is due in court charged with the murder of Constable Stephen Carroll in County Armagh earlier this month. PC Carroll, who was 48, was shot dead in Craigavon while answering a call from a woman who had a brick thrown through her window. The teenager is also accused of membership of the Continuity IRA and possession of a firearm with intent. Global stock markets surged last night after the US government announced plans to clean up banks' balance sheets by taking toxic assets off their books. The Dow Jones Industrial Average leapt by nearly 500 points, the biggest one-day rally since late October. Meanwhile, European markets also finished deep in positive territory, with the FTSE 100 putting on 2.9% during the day. We'll hear more about Obama's $1 trillion scheme later on in Guardian Daily. New evidence has emerged of alleged war crimes committed by Israel during the 23-day offensive against Gaza earlier this year. The Guardians revealed that Palestinians claim children were used as human shields and hospitals were targeted. And there's more coming up on that story too. The RPI measure of UK inflation is updated today. Economists have been expecting the Retail Prices Index, which includes housing costs, to have declined for the first time in 49 years, raising fears the UK is facing a damaging bout of deflation. 9 of the 10 executives who received top bonuses from the US insurance giant AIG have agreed to return them. New York's Attorney General says he hoped to recoup $80 million of bonus payments, about half of the $165 million paid by AIG on March the 15th. Since 2008, the US has rescued AIG with bailout funds totaling $170 billion. Looking at the morning papers now, The Times says pay freezes are starting to hit public sector jobs. They claim more than 1 million nurses, midwives and other NHS staff face losing promised pay rises. The Guardian reveals new evidence of Gaza war crimes. The alleged offences involve the use of Palestinian children, as we said, as human shields and the targeting of medics and hospitals. The Daily Telegraph says half of women and a third of men in England who suffer from cancer beat the disease. The Independent and Financial Times lead with details of Obama's toxic asset plan and the stock market's response. The tabloids continue to feature Jade Goody on their front pages. The Sun and Mirror have pictures of Jade's little helpers, her two sons, while the Daily Star gives details of Jade's funeral next week. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
A Guardian investigation has uncovered evidence of alleged Israeli war crimes in Gaza. It involves the use of Palestinian children as human shields, the targeting of medics and hospitals, and drone aircraft firing on civilians. Our correspondent Clancy Chasse has made three documentary films for The Guardian.
Well, the film follows the rather horrific tale of three young boys, 14, 15 and 16, three brothers, who were taken from their house at gunpoint and used as human shields to clear their neighbourhood of fighters. The Israeli soldiers took them to actually strip them down to their underwear, and for much of it they were bound and blindfolded. After being used to clear various houses, they were then taken to an encampment, a sort of makeshift Israeli tank position, where they were forced to kneel next to the tanks. And they were kept there actually for, according to the boys, 5 days. I think the entire ordeal took 5 days. They were held at this encampment for 4 days, and they were only fed on the fourth day. They were given water for the first few days, but they only received food on the fourth day, and only then it was a loaf of bread. So there are there's an Israeli organization that are looking, there are various Israeli human rights organizations that are looking into this case, particularly the detention, the way the boys were treated, the denial of food, being able to go to the toilet, kept in freezing winter cold outside with no clothes. So there were multiple violations, but this film focuses really on the use of these boys as human shields.
Which is in breach of Geneva Conventions. What is the Israeli government saying about this?
Well, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled against the use of human shields after there were various cases that came, you know, that arose, and there was video evidence of some of them. And I think in 2005, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled against it and said it violated international law. The practice has continued, though less so since the ruling. We asked Israel for an interview, but they declined to be interviewed and gave us a statement. And in the statement, they said, "We instructed our soldiers in this conflict not to use civilians as human shields," which rather suggests that they acknowledge they had used human shields before.
Now, tell us about the second film. This is the Israeli army targeting medical workers and other people carrying aid, taking aid to the Palestinians during the conflict that were being targeted by the Israeli military.
Yeah. There was a lot of indiscriminate fire going on in this conflict. As you know, more than 700 civilians were killed. 431 of them were children. So this comes in the context of what we're now finding out from Israel. It was an easing in the rules of engagement from the very, very highest level. It's very, very difficult to know why so many medical workers were targeted and why so many hospitals, because it was actually 15 of Gaza's 27 hospitals were damaged by Israeli fire. So it's more than half of their hospitals, and obviously 16 medical workers killed. Many of these were actually actively trying to tend to the wounded when they were killed. So it's very, very difficult to understand why so many were killed. Israel has in the past accused Palestinian fighters of hijacking ambulances or taking refuge in hospitals. But obviously, these films are looking into war crimes, and it's very, very clear under international law that it is never justified to target a medical worker or an ambulance or a hospital unless they are actively, directly involved in the fighting itself.
Now, the third film looks at the number of civilians killed, which, as you say, is very high, unusually high. And we go into some detail about the kind of weapons that the Israelis were using, because some of them could target people with great accuracy.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think because we understand that many, many civilians were killed using indiscriminate weapons in densely populated areas. For instance, artillery shells being lobbed into apartment blocks and white phosphorus being used over densely populated areas. In those cases, it's much easier to understand why so many people were killed. But what's shocking is the sheer number of people killed using precision weapons, not just Hellfire missiles from Apache helicopters or from the attack helicopters they use, which are also pinpoint accurate, or even tank shells. Many, many civilians were killed by tank shells, which are also very precise. This film focused on the most precise weapon system we think the Israelis have in their arsenal. And this is a weapon fired from a very, very small weapon fired from an unmanned aerial vehicle. So it's an armed drone that hovers around in the sky, is remote controlled from a booth outside the combat zone. And it fires a small rocket with a very, very intense small blast that will really just kill exactly what's targeted. And the optics, we are told, are exceptionally good. So the pilots who are controlling, or the operators who are controlling these drones, are able to identify exactly what they're going to target before they press the button to fire. And yet, Amnesty has found at least 49 cases of civilians killed by these highly precise drones. This is Major Chris Cobb-Smith. He's a former artillery commander. He's had nearly 30 years experience in the world's worst war zones and is considered a real expert in the field.
Why did we see so much indiscriminate killing of the civilian population? And I think questions have got to be asked and investigations have got to be done as to why that happened. We visited a case where a family, virtually an entire family, were killed in their courtyard by one of these drone attacks. They've been hit with an advanced weapon system with extreme accuracy. And to me, there's absolutely no excuse whatsoever for this.
Clancy Chassé reporting, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/Israel. Also on The Guardian's website today, John Henley on our changing relationship with our jobs. They're now our greatest asset, he says, at guardian.co.uk/G2. Hadley Freeman on female actors who are asked to play the mothers of male actors, despite being similar ages. Hope Davis says she was asked to play Johnny Depp's mum, even though she's 9 months younger than him. Read about that at guardian.co.uk/film. And how to deal with excessive blushing at guardian.co.uk/health. President Barack Obama's administration has revealed how it plans to buy up to $1 trillion of toxic assets from America's failing financial institutions. Between $75 billion and $100 billion will come from existing financial bailout known as TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program. The government hopes that private investors will provide 5% or more. The investment will be leveraged through a new body, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Federal Reserve. And in this way, huge amounts of bad loans can be acquired. The initial reaction to Timothy Geithner's initiative yesterday was positive, a surge in stocks on Wall Street. President Obama says the scheme would restore liquidity to the system. Michael Tomasky is in Washington.
The basic plan is for the government to create with Wall Street firms what in essence you might call a public-private hedge fund to bid on these troubled assets of these banks that are in difficulty. There would be auctions and a price would be arrived at. This is one of the sources of controversy because there's a big question in a lot of people's minds about whether these banks and these assets have some value but a limited value, or whether they have absolutely no value. So some of the critics of the plan say that people aren't going to bid. However, the government seems to have structured this auction in such a way that it will encourage people to bid because there is something in it for the private firms that do get into the bidding.
Banks take some of their bad assets off their books, sell them into a market, but do so in a way that doesn't just obligate taxpayers to buy at whatever price they're willing to sell these assets. Instead, involves a public-private partnership that allows market participants who have every interest in making a profit to accurately price these assets so that the taxpayers share in the upside as well as the downside.
Based on early returns, the plan does seem to have credibility with financiers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average went up 500 points Monday. Now, that doesn't mean, we should hasten to point out, that it's going to help Main Street or that it's the most brilliant plan ever devised by the mind of man. What that means is that Wall Street has looked at it and has seen a way for themselves to make money out of this deal. If Wall Street likes it, that means that Wall Street firms will indeed get involved in this bidding process. And if they get involved in this bidding process and buying up these assets, then that may clear the books for a lot of these banks. And a lot of these banks will then in turn be able to return to lending and giving extending credit to people and businesses, which is one of the big problems with the economy right now, of course.
It's not going to happen overnight. There's still great fragility in the financial systems, but we think that we are moving in the right direction.
I think to some extent this plan has yet to be announced in all its details, but that's a very common thing with government plans. You know, you get white papers are issued and broad outlines are issued. Details are really worked out on the fly of these things, and that's an extremely common thing. Everybody at Treasury, everybody on the president's economic team is now involved, and I'm sure have been involved for days in calling people at Wall Street firms, in calling people in similar positions in other countries, and somebody will have this objection and somebody will have that objection. And you know, as I say, these things get worked out on the run, but that's government work.
I'm looking forward to traveling to the G20 so that we ensure that the activities that we're doing here in the United States are effectively matched with comparable action in other countries.
Geithner has guaranteed his political survival for the time being. Obama said on the American news program 60 Minutes, a widely watched program on Sunday night, that Geithner was safe and that if Geithner even tried to resign, Obama wouldn't accept a resignation anyway. The positive reaction of the market and the mostly positive reactions from experts who comment on this sort of thing, I do think guarantees that that he's going to be around now for a little while.
I'm very confident that with the team that we've got assembled, we're going to be able to make it happen. All right? Thank you, guys.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Now the British economy. Internet-based DVD subscriptions, rosé wine, MP4 players and hot rotisserie chicken have all been added to the basket of goods and services used to calculate the official inflation rate in the UK. Out of the basket go 3-litre wine boxes, MP3 players and DVD rentals from shops. Every year, the Office for National Statistics announces the goods whose prices will be monitored to calculate inflation. And one measure, the Retail Prices Index, which includes house prices and mortgage costs, is expected to go negative today. Our economics correspondent Ashley Seeger explains.
The RPI is quite interesting. Normally we focus on the CPI, but the RPI, of course, is the broadest measure of inflation, and that looks set to fall below zero for the first time in about 50 years.
And why is that?
It's because the RPI embraces just about everything. It has mortgage costs, it has house prices, a certain measure of house prices in there, and it has energy costs in it, all of which have been falling very rapidly. You've seen house prices fall, you've seen interest rates cut from 5% to 0.5%, and you've seen gas and electricity prices are now starting to fall. So all of those three are exerting an extremely strong downward pressure such that it will go negative, possibly to minus 0.8-ish.
So we're talking deflation.
We are, in the strictest sense of the word. You know, that
prices
will represent
falling.
Prices falling year over year.
And what does that mean?
If it's a short, sharp deflation where prices fall for a short time, that's great for consumers in a recession because their money goes further and they might spend a bit more. It can help you get out of recession. But that sounds far too glib. It's a real danger that you get into a situation of constantly falling prices like Japan had in the 1990s and actually has gone back into now. And that's very, very dangerous because that encourages firms to cut their wages. Nobody buys anything because they think it'll be cheaper next week. Firms aren't selling anything, so they have to cut wages and you just get this spiral. And policymakers find it very, very difficult to deal with those. It's much easier if inflation goes up a lot, you can whack up interest rates, whack up taxes and inflation will fall. But in the converse, is much, much more difficult to deal with. So we should be worried about this.
And how will it affect pay deals linked to RPI?
Very interesting question. There are already some pay cuts being agreed as people take pay cuts in the hope of keeping their jobs. There are lots, about a third of all firms are this spring agreeing pay freezes with their staff. So lots of pay in the public sector is linked to RPI. So you have to ask the question, is that pay going to be cut? I think the government would actually be foolish to do it because they would contribute to a deflationary spiral if they did that. So while private sector who were suffering pay cuts would moan at public sector workers, there are about 5 million of them, about 20% of the workforce, people would be very unhappy if their pay went up 2% while everyone else's was falling 2%, for example. But it would be good macroeconomic policy for the government to do that.
And what about pensions?
Let's remember that pensioners, the state pension is uprated each spring in line with the RPI of the previous September. Now, you may recall that last September's RPI peaked above 5%. So pensioners are going to do very, very well this spring. We shouldn't forget that. What is interesting is that by this September, RPI could well be minus 3%, minus 4%. Next spring, just before the likely date of an election, is a government going to cut pensions? I very, very much doubt it.
And how will negative RPI affect student loans?
Well, it appears from what the Student Loan Corporation is saying that they will effectively be given money back. In other words, if they owe $1,000 a month, they'll only be asked for $950. the debt, well, already it will have fallen because of a falling RPI, but it will in theory go negative.
Now, the government's preferred measure of inflation isn't RPI, it's consumer price inflation. Do we expect that to follow suit and fall into deflationary?
Yes,
period?
Although not for a while yet. We were at 3.1 last month. It should go below 3 today, but most people think it'll go negative by the late summer. And it could well stay down there. And that's why the Bank of England has cut interest rates to 0.5, is doing all this quantitative easing.
Ashley Seeger. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, why Spanish shoppers are flocking to Gibraltar.
They are pouring across the border and spending their euros in everything from a local branch of Morrison's to Marks and Spencer's or Mothercare.
But first, the government hopes that a declaration of rights and responsibilities could become the living embodiment of a nation. We'd have the right to housing, healthcare, education, and freedom from poverty. And we'd have a responsibility to look for work in return for receiving benefits and to care for our children. The Green Paper was announced in the Commons yesterday by the Justice Secretary, Jack Straw. The last time a Bill of Rights was introduced into English law was in 1689. It curbed the powers of the monarch and it ended the divine right of kings. Alan Travis, our Home Affairs editor, told me what was in Jack Straw's bill.
Well, this is a Green paper, it's a consultative paper, and he's talking about having a Bill of Rights and Responsibilities. And in the rights element of it, he said, first of all, he said he's not going to repeal the Human Rights Act nor resile from that at all. That's quite an important statement to make in the current party political atmosphere, where there's a lot of speculation about what the government and the Conservatives might do with the Human Rights Act. He wants to build on the Human Rights Act, and he wants to enshrine explicitly a series of rights and responsibilities which are, as he's put it, scattered throughout the landscape of our legislative framework, constitutional world. So, for example, he's talking about enshrining economic and social rights, such as the right to free access to health treatment, as it's been there since 1948, and rights about rights to live in a sustainable world and in an environmental way, rights to childcare and other such rights, equality, such as, for example, equality rights, which are currently in existence and which were enshrined and brought together in a Bill of Rights. Now, what he's not saying, though, is, and he stopped short of this, which is that he's not saying you'll be able to go to the High Court and legally enforce these rights through a judge, which is what happens with rights under the Human Rights Act. And he's instead saying that by enshrining them in one document, he'll be able to sort of safeguard a progressive future, such as the right to free NHS access. And that's, I think, with an eye to a possible incoming Conservative government if there's a debate about free NHS treatment. And in a way that they would be sort of declamatory, sort of symbolic, but short of being legally enforceable. Now, alongside that would be a whole bunch of responsibilities as well. And what he means by responsibilities are such things like the right to vote, the right to pay taxes, the right for parents to bring up their children in a responsible fashion, and other such responsibilities. Now, they also wouldn't be legally enforceable. So, for example, he's not going to introduce a compulsory duty on everyone to vote, but he wants to enshrine in the Bill of Rights the right to vote, the duty to vote, so that it becomes a feeling of civic duty, a sort of declamatory kind of statement.
Now, the Tories are also proposing a Bill of Rights. This is very much a sort of politically charged issue at the moment, Alan.
It is, yes. And I think the Green Paper, which we won't see this bill emerge before the general election, be after the general election. And so what we're actually talking about is a kind of major debate shaping up for the party manifestos of that coming general election expected next year. And so we have Straw's version of his Bill of Rights and Responsibilities against David Cameron's British Bill of Rights. Now, the difference between the Conservatives is they've said they want to repeal the Human Rights Act, and their Shadow Home Secretary Chris Greening has talked of he wants to see fewer rights, more wrongs, which I think he means fewer rights of prisoners and writing more wrongs of victims. And this is kind of contending territory now, with the benchmark being whether or not you're going for Human Rights Act Plus, which seems to be what Jack Straw's going for, or Human Rights Act Minus, which is what the Conservatives appear to be going for.
Alan Travis. Now, don't forget to sign up to Guardian Daily on Twitter. Find out what's in the podcast before anyone else and have a look at who else is following us. Go to twitter.com/Guardian Daily. As we know, financial turmoil and recession are sweeping the world, but actually not all of it. Gibraltar is a 6 square kilometre rock off southern Spain, and its economy has grown at rates of up to 12%. It's more than doubled in size over the last decade. And as Giles Tremlett reports from Madrid, the weak pound is attracting even more Spanish shoppers to Gibraltar's shops.
Well, it's bucking the trend in several ways. One of the most important is the weak pound, which has turned it into a shopping mecca for Spaniards. They are pouring across the border and spending their euros in everything from the local branch of Morrison's to Marks and Spencer's or Mothercare.
Is it just sales of goods that are soaring?
No, it's not just sales of goods. Soaring is perhaps the wrong word for other things. Property, at least, is not falling. It seems to have flattened out. Other business is doing okay. The remarkable thing really is that in an environment where everything is going wrong everywhere else, Gibraltar is still swimming ahead of the tide.
A European court ruled in December that Gibraltar could set its own tax rates. What effect will that have?
Well, the feeling is that it's going to have a huge impact. It basically means that Gibraltar can set low corporate taxes. That should attract many businesses to set up offices there, and that in turn will increase employment, will bring in more taxes, and will increase the wealth of a place which already reckons to have the 13th highest GDP in the world.
Offshore tax havens are being subject to a lot more scrutiny these days, as we know. Will that affect Gibraltar?
Well, it might affect Gibraltar, but actually Gibraltar is a lot better off than most other places. The reason is basically that it forms part of the European Union. That means it has to obey European Union directives. So there's none of the banking secrecy of, say, Switzerland or Liechtenstein or Andorra. And in fact, it's ahead of the game, so to speak, of the Channel Islands or the Isle of Man, which aren't inside the European Union. So it's well down the list of places that are likely to be hammered by politicians looking for tax havens to get angry with.
Giles Tremlett in Madrid. Phil Maynard and Francesca Panetta produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.